They will come up and give the next set of presentations.
Okay, can everybody hear me all right? No? Better? Okay, my name's Colleen Whitney. I am with the California Digital Library. I'm also a student at the UC Berkeley School of Information. I'm here because I'm working on the Melville Recommender Project. There are others in the audience here, Brian Tingle, Steve Tobe, and Roy Tennant, who are part of the same project. It's an exploratory project. We're just tinkering with a whole bunch of different things. One is using a text-based discovery system, XTF, the Extensible Text Framework. It's open source. It's based on Lucene and Saxon. It's very flexible. It gives us a lot of different ways to configure the results. Enhanced relevance ranking. We're using Lucene's content-based ranking, and then on top of that, using holdings and circulation data to boost particular records higher. Index-based spelling correction, and some user interface strategies like Ferberization and faceted browse. Those are a little bit lower on the list of things that we're experimenting with. And recommending. I'm going to focus on that today. I could easily talk for 20 minutes on any one of these things. If you have questions about any of those other pieces of the project, feel free to come find me. I'd be happy to talk about them. And then Steve and Brian and Roy can also address those a little bit too. So we built a test bed of bibliographic records using exported MARC records from Melville, which is the union catalog for the UC system. We started by pulling 9 million records out to work with, UCLA and UC Berkeley records. And we experimented with, or we thought about, you know, using a smaller test bed, using a larger test bed, you know, based only on circulating items, based only on items that have ISBN numbers. We ended up settling on using the UCLA record set as the test bed, in part because we had very good circulation data associated with those records to work with. And this is important for the recommending aspect of the project. The circulation data from UCLA were particularly good because we had anonymized but persistent patron IDs across the 6 years of data that we had access to. We had data from two different systems, the Taos and Voyager systems, which, as you can imagine, made preparing the data for this project a lot of fun. We spent a lot more time massaging the data than we did actually working on the algorithms. Two different numbering systems, both local to UCLA, and we had to, you know, and the data structures were very different as well, so we had to do a lot of mining to come up with a structure on the back end that would be efficient to work with. So the basic idea is that patrons who checked this out also checked out these other items. You know, Amazon, lots of other places are doing this. It's not the same thing as collaborative filtering. Collaborative filtering requires that you know something about ratings that people have made. How well did they like the, you know, the various items? And also that you know something about the person who's, you know, about the user and about the habits of other users as well in order to make good predictions about what will be interesting to people. We don't really have that kind of data. The circulation data don't support collaborative filtering. We really don't have ratings. We can't assume that a checkout means that an item is useful. We also don't really know anything about how this patron's preferences or interests relate to the interests of other patrons, other than the fact that they may have checked out the same items. So this is not collaborative filtering, but we thought that it would still be interesting to experiment with how well we could use this circulation data set to generate recommendations that would be interesting to people. So the general idea is that you would follow relationships. So if you have this item and four patrons who've checked it out, you'd look at all the related items. And The issue is, you've got this large set of items, and in many cases, it really is literally hundreds of items that are related by those patron relationships. So how in the world do you take a large set of items like that and generate something that's going to be small enough? Because from the recommending literature, we found that 3 to 5 recommendations is really a usable set for most people. So we went back and so starting again with the same item and the 4 patrons who have checked it out, we again look at those relationships, but this time we're going to pay attention to which items they've checked out. So this first patron checked out 6 items. The next patron checked out many of the same items, actually, and so we're going to keep track of how many times we see those same relationships in the data set. Again, the next patron, many of them overlap. And then the last one, only one unique item. So we've got this set, and we can see that many of these items have been checked out multiple times or in tandem. So then we can sort based on the frequency of those relationships. So things that have been, things that we've seen that relationship multiple times for get pushed to the top of the set. Things that we've only seen once go to the bottom. So sometimes it's neat and tidy and you can cut it off and say, okay, we're going to return these 3, but it's not always that neat. So we tried using a subsort, using overall circulation, so things that have circulated more within the set, let's say of things that we've seen twice, frequency of 2, we subsort by overall circulation. I don't think it's actually the right way to do it, but it's a very easy way of ordering within that set so that you can make decisions about what to return first. Another suggestion that's been made, Dave Pattern at the University of Huddersfield suggested setting sort of a minimum frequency for returning recommendations. So if you've only seen it once, maybe you wouldn't return that set. I think the data are kind of sparse, so I'm not sure that that's the right way to do it either. So let's look at some examples. So we're looking at this work by Dorothea Lange, or about Dorothea Lange. And here's a recommendation set using that ordering method. And you can see some good consistencies in some of the general subject areas. The first one, social and political art, you can see that there are some thematic relationships there. But there are some, like item 3, I mean, it doesn't look particularly well related. And then again, As You Like It, a Shakespeare play, lots of items in the drama area, but look at the first one, Calculus. That particular calculus book appears to be a required text for maybe an introductory course, so it's going to show up a lot. People are going to be checking that out in tandem quite a bit. So we decided to try some content-based filtering. So let's say that item, you know, this item happens to be in one particular content area. Maybe we only want to look at related items that are in that same general content area. And as a very shorthand way of doing it, we decided to start with the first letter of call number class as a way of just making a quick cut. And the results got quite a bit better very quickly. If you look at the Dorothea Lange example again, the set looks much more cohesive in terms of the relationships with the original item. And the As You Like It, the calculus text drops out. Everything that's left is, you know, in the dramatic area. What's particularly interesting is that most of them are comedies. As You Like It is a comedy. You could not tell that from the subject headings that we have here. So it's actually rather interesting. But we don't really know whether these recommendations are useful to a scholar working in the field, which is really the best test of whether this method is going to be worth pursuing. So we're doing some user assessment coming up very quickly here to look at whether the recommendations that we generate using this method are appropriate for an academic audience, which is really the key test. So we expect to have results sometime in the summer. But now we'll get back to the more interesting stuff for this audience, I think. How does it work? The user queries XTF We are using AJAX. The recommendation script was written in Perl. It talks to a MySQL database that uses a lot of summary tables so that it's really quite fast. We generate them on the fly. Perl returns an XML response, and then the display is updated in the browser if the recommendations are present. And if I have time, I'll give you a live demo at the end here. So what is it that seems to work? Overall, the quality of the recommendations seems fairly good using that subject area filter, especially in the humanities. But again, this is subject to user testing. Severely off-topic recommendations are limited by that content filter, so we're not seeing the calculus text returned with the set of plays. And AJAX does seem to work well. It gives a smooth presentation without having to wait for the recommendations to come back. Even though they're fast, they're not as fast as XTF. So the user can be looking at the bibliographic record and the recommendations can come back just a second or two later. What is it that doesn't work? And as Tom mentioned, you know, really you learn the most by what does not work. And serendipity, which in the recommendation literature, people really like having recommendations made that maybe aren't quite exactly what they were thinking about, but it seems to strike a chord. And when we limit using that content filter, the historian probably isn't going to be seeing recommendations in political science and, you know, some other areas that might be related and interesting to his or her work, but will be eliminated by that filter. The content filter is very crude. As you know, that first letter of call number class is not the greatest way of coming up with general subject area groupings. The quality and quantity of recommendations in the science and technology areas is much lower than in the humanities. And it seems to me that that might be for two reasons. One, again, the subject area groupings in science and technology are really compressed into a small area of the call number class range. And then also the data are much more sparse. People in science and technology are using online resources that we really can't see given the circulation data. And then finally, there are a lot of records missing call number class data, and that eliminates recommendations for those items because we really can't, those get filtered out. Which brings me to ideas for further development. Refining the algorithm by improving the content filter seems to be, you know, the most promising way to make this better. Working on that right now, looking at some different mappings of call number class to general subject areas. There are some out at NYU, at Columbia, UC Irvine. So I'm looking at those probably within the next 2 weeks before we get into our user testing. We'll have that improved filter in place. And once that's also done, then experimenting with binning, we probably won't test this on users because it introduces complexity in the user interface that we probably don't want to worry about right now. But being able to present multiple smaller groups of recommendations rather than just one, so that that historian, you know, might be able to look at things in multiple content areas instead of just the one related to the item he's looking at. And then finally, backfilling some of that missing data, doing a little bit of mining of subject headings and call number class to see if, based on the items we have in the collection, we can look at those subject headings and predict which general content area it should go into if it doesn't have a valid call number class that we can use. We're also interested in experimenting with some other methods, doing similarity-based recommendations using some capabilities built into Lucene. That's actually underway, and I can show you that in just a moment. Using the same author, the same subject headings, those we can already do based on the capabilities in the system. And then also looking at whether there are connections we can identify using other external data sources like citations, like reading lists. I was talking to somebody yesterday about using tagging. There are lots of ways you might be able to look at relationships between different items and bring in other external data sources. And what's important is that these are not mutually exclusive. exclusive. All of these things can be brought together. The circulation-based recommendation method is really only good for the 25% of a research collection that circulates. It's actually a rather small part of it. And if we are really interested in encouraging people to explore that long tail, then we need to have other ways of generating recommendations besides the circulation-based method. So quickly, just many thanks. The Mellon Foundation has funded this work. RLG, OCLC, UCLA Library, UC Berkeley Library all contributed data to the project. And there are lots of people at CDL who have been involved in one way or another. And I'll post these slides somewhere if people are interested. There are links here to both the project homepage and to the prototype, which I'm going to... Looks like I have about just a minute or two to show you right now. So we've called our prototype Relville. Don't ask. But I'll do a quick search. My favorite search is XML. This is Roy's favorite search, too, because look where he shows up here. So... comes back very quickly, and then if we go look at the detail record, and I'll warn you, we're not done with the user interface for this detailed record, so it's just kind of a dump of the metadata. But you could see that these CDL recommendations popped in there just a second after the record itself did. And as I mentioned, the recommendations in the science and technology areas tend to be very diffuse. The content filter really doesn't work so well there. We're also pulling in, We're also pulling in Amazon Web Service recommendations using that same AJAX method. And you can see that, again, it's interesting to look at the differences between the similar items that Amazon is recommending and those CDL recommendations. I'll go back here. And then if you look at the recommendations for XML and libraries by Roy Tennant, you can see that the... These recommendations are actually pretty interesting. They're all in the sort of library and technology area. And just as a little teaser, this is very slow right now. This is that similar, it was very fast. That's right. So we're experimenting with that similarity-based method using some Lucene things. So you can see that the recommendations made using that method are different from the ones that we are generating using the circulation data. So it's very interesting to think about how those two strategies might work together. So that's it, which leaves about 5 minutes for questions, if anyone has any.
Well, in our breakout session yesterday, there was a lot of talk about demographic data and helping that to narrow down
I can tell you my personal position on that, and that is that people tend to be more task-based, and so making recommendations based on the item rather than on the person, to me, makes a little bit more sense, and especially given that we have actually very little demographic data attached to the circulation records that we have to work with. We might be able to look at whether they're faculty, undergraduate, graduate student. I'm not even sure. In the UCLA data, we don't even know what the major or the department is. In the Berkeley data, we did have that information, but we didn't have the patron IDs to use. So we haven't really, I haven't gone down that path very far, but I'd be interested in hearing what happens if you do.
Yeah, I'd like to give it a try. Roy mentioned in the session yesterday that, you know, if you've got a senior who's a biology major, he might be taking a philosophy course.
Exactly. Right. And things are very task-based, again. I mean, because you might be enrolled in different classes, because your interests change over time. It's like the Amazon thing where, you know, I buy a baby book for my friend and a science fiction volume for my husband, and then the recommendations I'm getting have nothing to do with anything I'm interested in. So.
You mentioned that you got 40 data from several sources. It occurs to me that maybe if the XSBN service returned total points for a word set for a verbal word set, then maybe that would... I mean, you said it would recommend your way to...
It's possible. I mean, one thing about this data set is that only about, I want to say, 30% of the records in this set have an ISBN. And so for the ones that have an ISBN, I agree with you. I think the groupings could really help. We're not using holdings data in this particular portion of the project. I can talk to you a little bit more offline about that, the ranking part where we are using the holdings data. And I agree, I think it would be really interesting to do those groupings in that work. Yeah, definitely. Raymond?
So
looking at this method and the CDL recommendations, or
you give the example of eliminating calculus.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It was discussed in the chat that sometimes, for example, especially multidisciplinary fields where you might actually be interested in recommendations that come from other subjects.
Yeah. And I think that's where the binning idea is very attractive to me. I mean, some of these sets that I have been working with, you might get things grouped under, like, almost every possible, content area based on those bins. And so I actually was experimenting a little bit with a method for figuring out which bins to put to the top, because you don't want to give somebody 20, sort of binned recommendation areas. So you might want to give them 3 or 4 that seem most related toward the top. But yeah, I mean, that is another possibility, is to allow for some configuration. Anything's possible. We just have to have time to mess with it. One last, yeah.
In the breakout session yesterday, I was pointed out that researchers might really object to having other people find out if they got 2 books and they established some relationship that could allow someone else to duplicate that relationship and give away their research. It really seems, to some extent, like this is like spying on people a little bit, if you go to Amazon, you sort of expect it, but in a library, there's sort of a different tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't really speak to that. There have been some user studies going on at CDL where they're asking people what kind of features they're interested in. Recommending comes out at the top very strongly. Whether or not people realize that that this might be one method of making recommendations, I don't know. But I think talking to the users about it is really the only way to answer that question. I mean, theoretically, sure, but I personally think it would be cool to see, what things other people are checking out in tandem, but I'm not a physicist, so I don't know.
It would be cool for someone to see what you're checking out.
Well, if they knew it was me, maybe not, but this is so anonymized. By the time it gets to this point, you have absolutely no idea, how the person relates to those pairings. So it doesn't seem like an issue, but I think talking to the users.
Unique correlations, and since you're trying to filter them
right
out, then statistics come into play. But unique correlations, it'd scare me a little bit if I was a researcher and I brought together a unique correlation and you were showing that to people, whether they knew it was me or not,
mm-hmm.
that the uniqueness of the correlation is important to somebody.
But you're the only person that's made that connection, that relevance would be pretty low, especially the population size is relevant.
Yeah, but you could be a book that nobody else has checked out, so
yeah, all theoretically possible, and I think I think the only way to find out is to is to try it out. We are doing, as I said, a series of user tests on this coming up pretty soon. And so, I mean, these are interesting questions to ask. Whether or not it would make people uncomfortable, I don't know.
Has Amazon published anything about how they do it?
It's interesting. We asked. When we were going through and looking at how, at making those connections into their web service, I actually had some correspondence back and forth with the guy who runs A9 at Amazon, and they won't tell. which is not surprising, so I don't know. Anyway, I think my time is probably up, so I'm going to have to...
Is your circulation database of just physical items checked out?
Just physical items, and that is a limitation. We don't know what people are doing in the library, obviously, and we don't know anything about use of electronic resources. So yeah, we only have a really partial idea of what they're doing. So thank you. Props too, flyers. There are some out on the table about this project and about XTF if people are interested.
So I hope, as you saw the screen cycling through, I hope that doesn't mean that our projector is being Dell-like again. Well, otherwise, we may have to.
I think it's because my laptop.
Hopefully. Right, okay, I'm Rob Sanderson from the University of Liverpool. When the call for proposals came out for this, I thought, hey, that sounds like a really cool conference. It's not your typical academic conference that I have to go to. So what would these guys be interested in hearing about? So I thought, well, the only way to really figure that out is to log into the IRC channel and see what people ask me about. So there were two main areas which I ended up talking about. One is my work with Cheshire, and the other is with SAU. And I have to talk about SAU an awful lot, so I'm going to talk about Cheshire. In particular, I'd like to talk a bit about doing some text mining on bibliographic data. And obviously, text mining without text. So first of all, I want to talk a little bit about the architecture that we use, that we've developed, information-wise. Then the processing architecture, you know, our computational resources, what text mining is, the data set, which is the same as the previous speaker, although an older version. Some of the naive expectations that I had coming into it, and once those naive expectations were rudely dispelled, what my actual results were, and whether we can draw any sort of conclusions from those results. So Cheshire has been around for 15 years or so in various incarnations. Cheshire 2 is the primary one developed by UC Berkeley, Ray Larson in particular, but also over the last 5 years by Liverpool as well. It's very focused on SGML. It's got a kind of monolithic structure. You've got two programs, you run them, it does its thing. You can extend it in C if you've got about 6 months to read through 250,000 lines of code. You can script it in TCL if you've still got your square brackets keys at the end of that. I always like to think about two words to describe a project. For Cheshire 2, I'd say search engine. Cheshire 3 is a derivative of Cheshire 2, designed by the guys at Berkeley and ourselves at Liverpool, but it's mostly developed at Liverpool. In particular, we wanted to refocus on XML rather than SGML, on Unicode, so multi-byte character support, and on standards rather than just doing what worked. We wanted an object-oriented approach rather than a big C library. It needed to be scalable. Google's got however many thousand servers to play with. If you only run on one processor, you're probably going to be left in the dust pretty quick. It also needed to be extensible, so we're using Python for that. My two words would be information framework rather than search engine. One of the the biggest issues that we've come across, like any little beastie, you need to be able to adapt to the environment that you find yourself in if you want to continue to live. So with that in mind, the architecture for Cheshire 3, we had several design issues in mind. We wanted to be able to reconfigure it really easily for unforeseen usage patterns. You know, if someone comes along and says, we want to do this really cool experiment, can we do it in Cheshire? We want the answer to be yes, and it's not going to be very hard, even if we hadn't thought of that cool experiment ourselves. For that, we need to be able to integrate other applications. We need to be able to say, here is your cool toy. We're going to pull it into our architecture, into the framework. You can do your stuff. We'll do our stuff. And hopefully, together, we'll get some cool results. We want terms from the query, normalize the terms, compare them to the terms in the index store, and return a result set. We then fetch those records that match from the record store. We can give them to a transformer, which takes a record in and produces a document, so it's an inverse of a parser. Return the documents to the protocol handler, which then get returned to the user. But hang on, we end up here with a group of documents. Well, we know what that is. That's a document group. So as you can see, why I started at the right-hand corner, we can then chain them all together, do a search for, say, for example, books which are written in English, or the records are in English, feed that back in to a new database without any hassles. I want to talk a little bit about how the processing objects are configured within the system, because it's kind of interesting, and it's important for the grid-based stuff I want to talk about next. So all of the objects, so all of the parsers, the transformers, and so forth, are configured via an XML record, which is a very simple common base schema with extensions as required for the different objects. The configurations, then, can be treated as a record object because they're just parsed XML, which means we can put them into regular record stores, which means we can distribute them via regular information retrieval protocols. So I could log in to my server, do an SIU search, and say, please give me the object part of speech preprocessor. And it would return the configuration. Obviously, there's a small bootstrapping process. You know, how do you find the configuration for the parser that will parse the configuration? So there's a couple of built-in, very small parsers and paths. Each object then has what I'd like to call a pseudo-unique identifier. They're unique within their context. So for example, one database might have an index workflow, which does database-specific stuff. Another database will have another object, which is also called index workflow, but does different things. And workflows, as I was just talking about, are objects in all of the above ways. So what's a workflow object then? A workflow object within Cheshire 3 contains references to other objects. So it's a logical collection of objects. Then there's some flow control for how to feed the results of one processing object into the next one. In Python, it's really nice. It's easy to do sort of dynamic code generation and compiling. So as soon as a workflow object is built, reads the XML configuration, turns that into Python code, and then we don't have to worry in the future about, oh no, we're going to have to parse the XML every time someone wants to do a search or ingest a record. One of the things that I talked about as one of our main design goals was standards-based, but these workflows are intentionally non-standard. The reason for that, well, they're specific to our architecture. You know, there's no point talking about a pre-parser object to somewhere, you know, which doesn't have this the particular model, which doesn't understand what a preparser object is. It's also dependent on the architecture. If you don't have the objects that are referenced, you can't fulfill the workflow regardless. What do they do for us? Well, everyone hates writing the same code over and over, even if it means just cutting and pasting from one file to another. These workflows can replace those boring lines of code. More importantly for me, they can replace lines of code which would otherwise need to be distributed around a grid. The design goals for the workflows, they need to be able to be easy to understand, so you can look at it and say, okay, I see what this workflow does, so then you know whether or what or not you want to use it. And they need to be easy to create. If it's easier to write the code to do it, why would you write XML that does the same thing? So we don't have $400 a share to buy our own big cluster. Unfortunately, that's Google rather than OCLC. So we can't guarantee when we're going to have processing time to do this sort of stuff. So we're working with San Diego Supercomputer Center, and in particular with the TerraGrid organization. So if we want some stats, here's the computational resources of the TerraGrid. So the cluster that I use mostly is this first one, the Itanium 2 one. So it's got 4 teraflops, 512 CPUs, so it's 60-odd nodes, each of which has 4 gigabytes of RAM. But because it's part of the grid, the TerraGrid, and I've got access to the TerraGrid rather than that particular cluster, I could equally log into the Cray at Pittsburgh, which has got 2,068 CPUs and 10 teraflops. They're not set up specifically to do information retrieval stuff, whereas SDSC are much nicer about it, so I tend to use the much smaller 4 teraflop cluster. So we've got a very simple processing model. Simply create the architecture on all of the nodes that we've got access to, and then distribute object identifiers and the data to those nodes to do the processing. So this is why workflows are so important. In the grid-based stuff, all we need to do is say, process index workflow for this particular object and do it at a node who isn't currently doing anything. The master then locates the data. Obviously, you need to be able to send it somewhere. Once the slave is finished, it returns success, fail, or an object reference to the master. Once it's finished, the master tells all the slaves to tidy up, and then it tells a subset of those slaves to merge the results. So just to demonstrate that a little bit more clearly, after we've built the architecture in phase zero, in phase one, this master will go to, in this case, a data grid called the storage resource broker, and it pulls back file paths of where the data is that we want to process. It then distributes those file paths out to the slaves, so slave one gets file path one and slave n gets file path n. They do their processing, extract the data out into temporary storage until you've finished processing all of the files that you want to handle. In stage two, we send a sort and load request out to the individual slave nodes, which go out, collect all of the results of the individual extractions, merge them together, go back to the data grid and store the indexes that we've generated. So that's where we can get the processing power to do some interesting things. And one of the interesting things that I thought we might like to try and do would be to apply the text mining work that we've been doing with the National Centre for Text Mining in the UK to library data. So we're working with NACDEM. We provide Cheshire 3 as our as one possible information architecture. The other one that's been decided on is IBM's UEMA. So what's text mining? Common definition would be discovery of previously unknown facts from text. Involves normally part of speech tagging for words, so is fish a noun or is fish a verb? Discovering chunks, discovering noun phrases or verb phrases, recognizing the subject, the verb, the object for clauses, recognizing particular entities, so is this genome the same as this other genome? And most importantly, it's computationally expensive, although obviously it's coming down as the field gets more work. So I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, there is no text in bibliographic data. There just isn't. What is this guy doing standing on the stage talking about text mining? Well, yeah, you're perfectly correct. There is not a lot of text in MARC records. But when you've got quite a lot of them, and for this case we have 16.5 million of them, there's an awful lot of little bits of text, in particular in the titles. As we heard from Colleen, Melville is the UC catalog. This is an older version exported quite a while ago. But the MARC records are your typical bulk standard kind of MARC records. So again, mea culpa. I proposed the talk without having done all the work. Here are my particularly naive expectations of what might come in the data. So it's a big institution, but it's in the US, so surely most of the books will be in English. There'll be lots of nouns and titles. Yep, that was pretty much a given. There'll be some verbs and adjectives, not many adverbs. The analysis was going to take a lot of power, a lot of processor time to do. I thought that the part of speech tagger that I use, which is developed by the University of Tokyo, would cope okay with titles even though they're not real sentences. I thought there'd be some meaningful adjective and noun phrases. Verbs would be somehow important as they're kind of rare. With about 16 million titles, there should be enough text to do some interesting stuff with. Subject headings, you know, they're supposedly controlled access fields. Surely they're going to be, you know, vastly more standard, vastly more regular than phrases pulled out of titles. And most importantly, I expected that the Terra Grid, who has, you know, however many full-time sysadmins, wouldn't have unexpected downtimes just when my job was about to do its thing. And you can guess what the answer to that one was. Okay, so some basic stats. Languages, there were 610 unique keys in the data. Obviously the most common was English, but it was only 65%. There's only about 10.5 million books in English. In slash A, maxed out the I don't know what this is with 834,000. Pipe had 68, and then Pipe A had 26. So there are some books which could be English, or they could not. So from my 16.6 million, I'd find myself only with about 11 million. So there goes some of the text which I thought I'd have. Then there's some the other major languages, you know, almost a million books in German, 500,000 plus books in French, 250,000 in Japanese, Italian, and Chinese. When I was writing the slide on Monday, I thought, you know, hey, you know, I should probably say, you know, the actual numbers for how many books there are. And then I realized that I hadn't indexed it. So I logged into the Terra Grid and said, you know, can you give me some power? You know, give me some CPUs, and it said, yep, okay, you can have 32 CPUs. And then, you know, 440 seconds later, I'd indexed all 16.6 million records. So it's about 35 1,700 records a second. At that rate, across the entire TerraGrid, you could do real-time searches on the entire Library of Congress without any problem. Subject-wise, there's about 1.5 million different subject field values. That seems an awful lot. Surely there's not that many in LCSH. Oh, yeah, oops, 650 versus 650A. There was only 127,000 different values for the A subfield. The most popular was popular music, with 143,808. Interesting. LCCN, 1,897 unique values with just the leading letters. Average was about 2,000 for each letter. Now, the biggest, which you could probably predict from the subjects, was M being music. So, part of speech tagging, this linguistic stuff. With 11 million titles, there's an awful lot of junk. And part of speech taggers don't deal well with junk, especially when they're not even supposed to be full sentences. So I ended up with a lot of stuff which it said, this is a noun. That was just garbage. It doesn't recognize it, it thinks, well, I don't recognize it, so it's probably a noun. So I needed to put in some sort of filtering system. The fairest system I could discover was dropping words that had embedded numbers and dropping words that had terms with less than 10 occurrences. So after that, the part of speech forms, there was 141,000 different noun forms, so I picked that one right. With the total occurrences, so that's one per record, even if it's more frequent within the record, 92.5 million nouns in Melville, or in my copy of it. Verbs, 15,473, of which the most frequent one was edited, which was a surprise for me for about 30 seconds, and then realized, well, yeah, okay, that does make sense. But it's not particularly useful for determining the book. If you search for edit as a verb in title, you're going to get anything. So that didn't pan out. Verbs weren't particularly important for doing good searches on title. Adjectives, about 14,000. Everything else, 2,000, but about 30 million occurrences, which again isn't surprising because there was 4.8 million copies of the word the. Adverbs, yeah, there's not very many of them either, probably because there's not many verbs. Only 2,000, of which there were less than a million occurrences. So for doing that, I could get about 8,000 to 10,000 8,000 to 10,000 records a second using 50 machines, which is obviously a lot less than 37,500. With linguistic stemming, splat. My GPFS stuff fell over because some of the disks blew up. Not my fault. I did own up, and they said no, it was hardware. Title phrases, started off 3.5 million unique ones, but filtered down to 282,000. But comparing that to subjects, there's still not a lot of phrases per subject on average. Not quite fair because there's going to be a lot of junk in 650A, so filtered that, and it still ended up being one subject for every six phrases in title. So there's not necessarily any correlation there, but it's an interesting stat. So finally, thumbs up or thumbs down, is it worthwhile? So here are some of the benefits quickly. No stop lists, don't need, there's 2,000 different things. Most stop lists aren't 2,000 items long. You have part of speech differentiation and indexes, fish as a verb versus fish as a noun. You could have noun phrases instead of or as well as inter-term proximity, which will obviously increase the speed. With props to the keynote, you could have recommending systems which filter on noun phrases rather than arbitrary words. Benefits obviously are limited because there's not that much text. Future work, we're doing a pilot project with some London libraries, but most importantly, will we work to mediate the computational cost of doing it, so you don't need a grid to do this sort of stuff, versus the benefits that you can get out. Thank you. Do I have time for some questions? One?
Maybe one while he's setting up.
Yep. Question? Nope. Yep.
Would that be useful if you could use more of note fields and
hard records? I looked at note fields, but most of them say things like contains bibliography or similarly useless things for actually doing searches on. That could have just been this particular data set, but that, from experience with our OPAC, is pretty much all that you get in as far as text goes in note fields in most OPACs. So, yeah, we tried it, but it didn't work out. Okay, thank you.
Hi, my name is Ryan Chute. I'm with the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and just kind of introduce you to some of the work we've been doing in the research library there. And what I'm introducing you to is the DOOR archive, which is a file-based storage of digital objects and constituent data streams. It's a solution for those. So first we'll kind of introduce you to XML tapes and ARC files, which are the technologies we use for the file-based storage of XML and binary data. Then we'll introduce you to how we're using OAI PMH and OpenURL to access the content stored in those two file-based storage mechanisms. And then kind of introduce you to the overall framework, which is the DOOR archive. What is an XML file? An XML file is essentially inline XML content within a wrapper that is an XML file. So it's got an open-ended tape-level administrative section that you can put any kind of descriptive data inside of it. So in our particular use case, we use DIIs, we can use Dublin Core, DC terms for formats and collection information. Then the tape records, each record has administrative section which contains identifier and date stamp information, which will be later used for the OAI PMH request. And the metadata that's stored is actually can be from any XML namespace. In our particular use case, we use Diddle, but in other cases, you could use Mets or even just simple cases like mods. This is just a quick snippet of basically what an XML tape looks like. It's just a simple structure. All of our date stamps are UTC to be compliant with OAI PMH. Then, as you'll see, just within the tape record element, there's the metadata that can be from any namespace. In this case, it was Diddle. The indexing technology can be as really independent of, is absolutely independent. And what it does is it contains identifier, date stamp, length, offset, and set information. The key to this is basically the parser runs through the XML file, and it indicates that I've reached the new record, and it indicates where the offset from the top of the file to where that file to that record begins. Then what it does is it calculates the length of the record, and then indexes both of that content. So later we can actually do random access and just get from that offset for that length. And that information is stored within an external index file. So on the flip side, we use, for binary streams, we use ArcFile technology, which was originally designed and developed by the Internet Archives for the Wayback Machine, which basically archives all of the web's contents. ArcFile format is structured with an administrative file header at the top of the file. Then each document record, which is actually stored within the ArcFile, contains an administrative section which indicates where it was harvested from or some kind of unique identifier, then the time that it was archived, and then also the size of the data block. Then whatever kind of data stream that you have is stored inside there. So in typical case would be like a HTTP GET, just the whole payload is archived there. So here's the example of the structure. The file description at the top is the actual ARC file tape information. The metadata, the columns are actually stored at the top of each ARC file, and that's the record header columns. You'll also see that the two instances I have as examples indicate the information that's stored within an ARC file. The first case is a MARC XML information, and the second one is actually a PDF. So the MIME type that's recorded in there is used for retrieval when we actually encode the send the byte stream back to the end user. So the indexes that are used are actually CDX files, which are standards developed by the Internet Archives, which have set columns that can be used by a variety of different technologies. In our particular case, we're using Heritrix API, which is distributed by the Internet Archives. Now we'll introduce you briefly to the protocols that we use to access this content. We use both OAI, PMH, and OpenURL. So in order to access XML tapes using OAI, PMH, we have a base URL, which is composed of a gateway servlet and a unique identifier for the particular XML tape. Then we have an identifier, which is a unique identifier for the record. And then we have the intel and from the standard OAI components. For simplification, each XML tape can only have one metadata format. Because you can generate any number of XML tapes, it simplifies things by having all the content within one XML tape all being of the same type. And by default, all of the XML tapes, the OAI PMH repositories all accept kind of a generic native metadata prefix, which just allows you to always go and get the metadata that's contained within the record element, and you don't have to worry about, you know, is it diddle information in there, is it METS information, it'll always get that regardless of what repository you go to. You can also add in your own metadata formats as well. The supported granularity is second level. For accessing content within ARC files, we use OpenURL. The requests are comprised of a base URL, which is an OpenURL resolver, then the referent ID, as well as the resolver ID. So this information is all sent in, and then the byte stream is sent back with the MIME type. It's all ready for the end user to use it within whatever particular end-use application. Now we'll kind of introduce you to the components that make up the Ador archive. So in order to actually have associations between XML tapes and ARC files, what we do is there's two different ways that we make references. The first case is that we actually store references to the constituent data streams within the actual archive content or within the metadata itself. So in the case of diddle, we use the resource tag to actually make a reference, an external reference to the content, which is this OpenURL call. And then the other case that we use is that we actually associate it at the file level. So within the XML tape, there's a tape admin section, which is part of the extensible framework. It's just one of the plugins that we have, which just calls another schema. And in this case, we have ARC file ID, which, so if you have content that references one ARC file, you just have one reference there. Otherwise, you have n number of ARC file references. So it's an easy way of kind of keeping track of all of the associations between XML tapes and ARC files. So for ingestion, we have an interface that we've implemented that allows you to easily kind of say, okay, I already have pre-processed content, and I just have an XML tape and an ARC file. I just want you to register it in the system so that I can get you access to it over OAI and as well as OpenURL. Alternatively, if you have source metadata formats from, like our use cases, we get content from BIOSIS, we get content from ISI, and we want to standardize it and normalize it so that it's all common within our environment, we do pre-processing, which is part of this, the pre-processing interface, where we actually transform all the content into diddles that are they're identical in structure, but they have different content, so that we have basically a common way, so we're always calling diddles instead of different kind of metadata types. After you've done that pre-processing, what it does is it registers the content within the ARC file registry and XML tape registry. These are just simple MySQL databases with OAI PMH front ends that store information about what is this ARC file, what is this XML tape's ID, where can I find it, what is it? What sets are contained in it, what are the date stamps, just kind of quick identity information. So this is the Adore archive environment, just kind of in a pretty sense, in a nutshell. What it does is it's contained of the... X-